Hi, this is Al Bergstein for KPTZ. Today we have a special show on the life and times of Wolf Bauer. Wolf died in January of 2016, and yet his remarkable life as pioneering mountain climber, kayaker, coastal geologist, and environmentalist is one of the most important but little told stories in Northwest history. Wolf Bauer was a pioneer all his life, a man of many firsts. The scope of his influence has been so broad and spans so many years that few even begin to grasp it. Hundreds or even thousands of mountaineers have pioneered new routes in the Northwest, but the number of people who have pioneered new movements is far smaller. To introduce a new technical foundation, a new approach to safety, or an entirely new branch of mountain sports is an opportunity given to very few. To have done this several times in a lifetime is truly extraordinary, yet Wolf Bauer did exactly that. Skier, climber, rescuer, kayaker, and conservationist, Wolf Bauer excelled in all of these fields. But what truly set him apart were his efforts behind the scenes, working quietly and persistently over a lifetime to enable others to excel and to do so safely. Wolf Bauer's influence on outdoor recreation in the Northwest was unparalleled. He was at it since 1925. Wolf's mother's family, the Eplers, were Seattle pioneers. His mother attended school in England and spent summers in the Alps, where she met his father. Wolf was born in Bavaria in 1912 and immigrated to Seattle with his family in 1925. Unable to speak English fluently, he was put in the first grade. Each month, as his English improved, he was promoted a grade. By the end of the year, he found himself back in junior high. As Malcolm Bates wrote in Cascade Voices, it was perhaps the only time in Bauer's illustrious life that he had to catch up. More often than not, Wolf Bauer had been the leader. Wolf began skiing in 1919 as a schoolboy in the Bavarian Alps. His wooden skis were heavy and long. The bindings were flat-toe irons passed through slots cut sideways through the skis, then bent up to fit his hiking boots and threaded with leather straps. In 1921, the film A Fox Hunt on Skis Through the Engadine inspired Wolf and thousands of Europeans to learn the new alpine skiing techniques of their hero, Hans Schneider. Wolf witnessed the ski boom in Europe in the early 1920s, and after he arrived in America, he saw it echo in this country a decade later. In Seattle, Wolf joined the Boy Scouts and was invited by his scoutmaster, Harry Higman, to accompany him on a ski outing to Stampede Pass. Trying to load a streetcar for King Street Station, Wolf got his first clue that skiing was not yet a household word in the Northwest. "Poking my evil-smelling slats through the streetcar door at the conductor," he later recalled, "I was bluntly informed that the system was not in the lumber hauling business, and that whatever it was that I was carrying did not come under personal and reasonable luggage." Fortunately, an old Swede came to his aid, and the two of them managed to convince the conductor that the skis were, in fact, sporting equipment. In autumn of 1929, Wolf was one of three scouts selected annually to receive a free membership in the Mountaineers. With a few exceptions, the club's skiers were mostly novices. Wolf brought to the Mountaineers both skiing know-how and the competitive fire. In March 1930, he won what was perhaps the first slalom race west of the Mississippi at the club's Meany Ski Hut, using linked telemarks. That same day, he placed third in the state's first downhill race. The Mountaineer downhillers started en masse and could choose their own routes. 3 years later, Wolf won the race by taking a shortcut right into space over the cornice at the top of Meany Hill. In 1930, the club held its first patrol race, an 18-mile dash on skis between the Mountaineer lodges at Snoqualmie Pass and Stampede Pass. This was a team event with three skiers per team, each required to carry a 10-pound pack of survival gear and finish within a minute of each other. Wolf was too young to race that year and broke the trail instead. In the late 20s and early 30s, a small number of mountaineer climbers set new standards for difficult and adventurous climbing in the Cascades. These climbers were self-taught and generally unfamiliar with the most recent developments in climbing techniques in Europe. Wolf and his younger friends found the old guard unapproachable and felt they were reluctant to pass on their skills to the newcomers. Wolf decided to teach himself using books acquired from Europe. In 1933, Wolf got permission from the Seattle Area Council of the Boy Scouts to offer Explorer Scouts basic mountaineering instruction. For rock climbing practice, he took them to a glacier boulder near his Seattle home called Big Rock or Wedgewood Rock. This instruction was the germ of the Ptarmigan Climbing Club, a group of former Boy Scouts who a few years later would make their own mark in Cascade history. Wolf corresponded with acquaintances in Europe in what he later described as an almost frantic effort to catch up with the Alps. Wolf practiced techniques in dark secrecy. He made his first free-hanging rappel off the Cowan Park Bridge before showing them to his mountaineer students. He taught snow climbing, self-arrest, and crevasse rescue techniques at the sand bluffs of Fort Lawton, which is now part of Discovery Park. During the summer of 1934, Wolf teamed up with Hans Greig to make two unsuccessful attempts on Ptarmigan Ridge. The formidable north spur of Mount Rainier is visible from Seattle. Greig had attempted the ridge in 1933 with Wendell Trosper and Jarvis Wallen. During the 1935 climbing course, Wolf and Jack Hossack, one of his students, decided to give the route another try. After Labor Day, they approached the mountain from the Carbon River. Over 2 days, they climbed to the summit, spending 12 hours cutting steps up the steep ice slopes and bivouacking along Liberty Cap. The route was the first up the north side of Mount Rainier and the hardest ice climb yet completed in the Northwest. The following winter and spring, Wolf taught the mountaineers climbing course again, this time divided into basic and intermediate levels. The intermediate course included instruction in the use of pitons for rock climbing. Near the end of the course, Wolf and four of his students decided to try Mount Good, a remote summit that had repulsed the best Cascade climbers of the day. Bauer's party not only succeeded on their class project, but also ushered in the Iron Age of climbing in the Northwest, placing pitons for the first time on new routes in the Cascades. His standard-setting climbs on ice and rock would by themselves earn Wolf a lasting place in Northwest climbing history, yet his efforts to reach others had a far greater impact. Students from his 1936 course included Omi Daber, mountain rescue icon and leader of the team that climbed Liberty Ridge just 2 weeks after Wolf's Ptarmigan Ridge ascent, William Dengenhart, one of the greats of the old guard and a future president of the Mountaineers, and Lloyd and Mary Anderson, who founded Recreational Equipment Co-op in 1938 to provide gear for the growing ranks of course graduates. The Mountaineers Climbing Course became the model for similar club and college programs throughout the West. In 1946, The Climber's Notebook, a compilation of lecture notes from the course, was published as a paperback book. In 1960, after years of work by hundreds of volunteers, it became Mountaineering, the Freedom of the Hills, the most widely used climbing text in North America. Like a stone thrown into a pool, Wolf's influence spread outward. For several decades following World War II, if you asked any prominent Northwest climber how they got started, chances are they would begin, "Well, I took the climbing course in the 19-so-and-so." Historian Harry Majors has called the creation of the Mountaineers Climbing Course the single most influential event in the history of Cascade mountaineering. Following his climb of Liberty Ridge in 1935, Omi Daber was called to help in a winter search for Delmar Fadden, a young climber who perished during a solo climb of Mount Rainier. Later, Daber became an informal focal point for organizing rescues. In the late 1930s and 1940s, the Mountaineers maintained a list of experienced climbers, graduates of the climbing course, who were willing to be called on for search and rescue operation. A central committee made up of the climbers' wives, which was humorously called the Call Girls, managed the phone list. After World War II, this informal group was increasingly called upon to help people outside the Mountaineers. In his work as a ceramic engineering consultant, Wolf often traveled to Europe. In 1948, after visiting a client in Holland, Wolf spent time in Bavaria, where he learned about the Bergwacht, which is the Mountain Watch, a volunteer rescue group much like the National Ski Patrol in the United States. Wolf obtained a film of the Bergwacht in action and some books about their methods. He realized that, as in skiing and climbing in the 1930s, Europe was ahead of the U.S. in rescue techniques and organization. Wolf concluded that a similar organization was needed in the Northwest. In 1948, he approached the Mountaineers, Washington Alpine Club, and the National Ski Patrol to sponsor a new organization. He brought in the Ski Patrol, Coast Guard, Forest Service, and other government agencies to participate. Originally called the Mountain Rescue and Safety Council, the name was eventually shortened to the Mountain Rescue Council. Wolf served as a chairman of the Mountain Rescue Council for its first 6 years. Local rescue councils were formed in Longview, Bremerton, Yakima, Bellingham, and other cities to respond more quickly to accidents in nearby mountains. It was during this time in the mid to late 1940s that Wolf met two brothers from West Seattle, Jim and Lou Whitaker. They need no introduction now to those in the climbing world, but at the time they were young climbers that participated in early rescues. Today, we have in the studio Jim Whitaker, who was the first American climber to summit Everest, along with being the first employee and CEO of Recreational Equipment Incorporated, otherwise known as REI Co-op. Jim's career in climbing has led him back to Everest a number of times, as well as many times successfully climbing a wide range of peaks in North America. His brother Lou Whitaker became the most experienced guide for climbing Mount Rainier with over 250 summits and established Rainier Mountaineering, developed a group of successful climbing-related businesses at the Rainier Base Camp in Ashford, Washington, which is adjacent to Mount Rainier National Park. Lou also led the training of several generations of Rainier guides, many of whom continue to guide and climb elsewhere. He also led the first American ascent of the North Col of Mount Everest in 1984. So welcome, gentlemen. Thank you very much for being here today.
Hello there, Al.
Hi, Lou.
Hey, Jim.
Yeah, good. You're in Sun Valley?
Yes, it's raining hard.
Oh, no, the skiing isn't that good then.
Right. You know, Wolf was quite a skier. We knew of all his other talents, but he held a record there, still holds it from Snoqualmie Pass to Meany. He skied that thing in 4 hours and 37 minutes and 23 seconds from Snoqualmie to the Mountaineer at Meany.
Yeah. And the other thing he's done, Lou, is the silver skis, and I just about died laughing. We were with Wolf at the Mountain Rescue celebration at Mount Hood a couple of years ago, and
right.
Wolf told me about how they got up there on the silver skis. That was on Mount Rainier, and he got to the... So they're up there at Camp Muir now. They've hiked up, and they're ready to go, and... At that time, they started the races, everybody at once. They didn't clock them. They're all standing there abreast at Camp Muir, 10,000 feet, and they push off, and it was amazing. He said everybody's trying to get to the first gate, right? So they're all shoving, and he's in the front, and he makes the turn, and one ski comes off. As he's doing his thing, and he gets it back on, and then catches up to the guys, and then he's going, and then he's finally getting around, and he gets to the number one guy who's just making the final traverse over down to Edith Creek Basin, where the finish line was. And he said he was in the track. I forget what that guy's name was, but he said he was in the track with him, and he said he was kind of timing it. And he said so when it looked like he was clear, he shot out into the deep snow and passed him and finished up first on the silver skis. Isn't that neat?
That is an amazing story, and it's amazing because I have skied off of Muir down that snowfield, and it can be pretty brutal sometimes.
Well, yeah.
Jim, remember we took on one of those races we dragged the toboggan? We were ski patrol. It was up there in the mid-40s.
Yeah, that's where I got a terrible burn. I had blisters on my face before we got home.
Hey.
That's right. Third, I did too. Yeah. Oozing blisters.
That's, man.
That's... But, you know, Wolf, up at base camp at Mount Rainier there where we live, we've got a climbing rock. It's about 12 feet tall, 15 feet tall, with a lot of handholds in it. And he walked over to it at the age of 95. He was visiting us. He walked over and he climbed the overhang wall at the age of 95. I'm not near there yet, but there's no way I could do it.
I know. I mean, he was gifted. He was gifted in music. He was gifted in writing and books and poetry and
I know.
And water, the sea. He loved the sea. He loved the mountains. He was really a talented guy.
Were you able to find the kayak club, the Mountain Rescue Council with Omi and Otto Trott? Those three guys taught you and I a heck of a lot about mountaineering.
When did you first meet him? Do you remember the first time you met Wolf?
I think it was on a mountaineers training rescue program.
Oh, yeah, okay. In the 40s, and we met, I know he was on the Source and Rescue on Mount, on the Brothers in the Olympics. That was kind of the start. And then, Jim, when you and I went
to Mount St. Helens,
and the guy.
Yeah, but I think.
Shoot us out for climbing without a rope.
Yeah. But I think he was one of the instructors at the Mountaineers as well when we first started glissading and so forth up at Snoqualmie Pass.
I see.
Oh, yeah.
But Wolf was a sweet guy too, Al. I mean, just a wonderful person. But we went on a rescue, Lou, and up on Jesset fell into a crevasse up on, I don't know if you know that story, but he fell into a crevasse and his team came down. He had the rope around him when he went in so that they couldn't recover him.
Right.
So we went up. We got jumped in a car. I think Ala was driving, and Wolf and Omi and Louie. And we got in the car. And then we got up to the base, up to Spirit Lake, and there was a snowcat ready to take us up a little bit higher. Mm-hmm. And so we went up a little bit higher, and so we're assembling there. And Louie and I were pretty gung-ho and young. What the hell? We're still in high school, Lou?
No, just in the first year of college.
Yeah, first year of college. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we looked around. We said, you know, he could still be alive. Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty big party. Maybe Louie and I, we ought to go first and get up there as fast as we can and see if maybe we can get down to him. We didn't rope up, so that's when we saw another side of Wolf. He was really pissed off.
He said, you never climb unroped on a glacier, and there were holes up there, but
we had footprints.
Coin and Jim went down and discovered that he was dead. And
well,
Jim, 66 college feet.
Yeah, but remember that, Louis? We stood there and flipped a coin to see who was going to go down first. We were, you know,
that's
pretty
right.
Early. So we flipped a coin. I won the cost, and so Louis laid me down as I went down looking for him. And I got down there, and I couldn't see him. And the crevasse by then was so narrow that my shoulders were touching, and I couldn't see him, and I was standing on a block of snow, and then I saw a hand sticking up through the snow.
Right, that story is in the book that you had. I didn't realize there wasn't the part of that Wolf was mad at you, though.
Yeah, no, that I didn't write that in. But Wolf was he's a great guy.
Mm-hmm. Did you know, Jim, that Green River flows down, there's a state park there called the Fleming Geyser State Park, and we were at his honorary naming of the lodge up there, and so Wolf Bauer Lodge is on the Green River in just above Seattle there in the Fleming Geyser State Park.
And a little side thing to that, Lou, I was on the State Parks Commission assigned by Albert Rosellini, and we authorized the naming of that state park.
We went there when he was honored with it, and he was a humble guy. He didn't brag or anything else. He was just so damn talented and just took it for granted.
And then you got to know him, Lou, well, because he'd stopped at Whitaker's bunkhouse up there at Ashford, and you guys had chatted.
Yeah, I skied into his 90s, and my wife Ingrid became a close friend of Wolf's because she's from Munich, and they spoke German, and she was really close to him. And his last year, we visited him up in the San Juans up to his 103rd birthday, and they'd talk and have some great memories. He'd ask about Munich, and they'd talk about Europe, because that's where the guy was born. Yeah. He came over here with a knowledge, climbing knowledge, to say, hey, you guys need a mountain rescue council. And at that time, planes were crashing all over the place. And so we, besides our climbing rescues, why, we went after planes a lot. Jim, you remember those, some of those on, remember Mount Rainier when we went up and...
I was trying to figure out if Wolf was on that.
I don't think so. Well, we were in high school, but he wasn't there. But I think that that was where we started. He started saying, "Hey, we need." And remember, everybody had bailed out except the pilot, it back to McCord Field.
A military. So
we spent a week up there. We were in high school, never did find the guy, last guy that was missing, but he was found a few weeks later and the parachute is hung up in the trees. Anyway, that's
I remember then
I think was starting to kick in the idea of a mountain rescue council for planes and military and everything. It was just after the war.
Then another one up there by the plane, they didn't clear the ridge and they crashed into the rock. You with
that? Yeah, by Big Four.
Yeah, by Big Four. And there were pieces all over. And we had to go up through the dogwood. But I remember
Wolf was on that one.
Yeah, I think he might have been. And I remember the one we were on at Rainier, they bailed out. Excuse me, because we couldn't find anybody in the... The problem was we were looking for parachutes, but there were patches of snow in the trees, and it was raining like hell. And I remember one day Louis was assigned to keep the fire going at the camp, and we went out looking, and we looked until dark, and we're coming back, and Louis had this fire on. He kept that damn thing going the whole day. And so when we came back, we're looking, and we see this light flickering into the trees, and we come up, and here's Lou down there about 15 feet. He's melted out the damn snow, and he's got this fire down there, and it went all the way down the ground. We couldn't believe it. We're looking.
I remember that. Wolf said, you know, Lou, if you... The next time, find a stump and build it on a stump. You don't have to melt down so far.
That's great. That's great.
Yeah. No, so he was a great guy. Yeah.
He came from Germany in 1925, so he beat the World War II. And then started influencing local climbers here. And he tried to talk Jim and I into kayaking, but we were scuba divers and snorkelers. Skin divers, and we went into that phase of it.
But I had one of his full boats, Lou, on Lake Sammamish when we were.
Yeah, he was the first
when we were there.
Full boats over, and then
and that was his deal.
The kayak club.
But he also, you know, he the berming of beaches and so forth. He revolutionized the salvage of beaches by having gravel on it instead of building bulkheads, and so he revolutionized the whole beach process. The other thing, Al, when I think about Wolf, then I think about Omi and Otto, Omi Diver, Otto Trout. But these guys, I mean, being around them, they were jokers. They were just funny people, and they were pulling tricks on each other and stuff like that. It was just amazing. They're really funny, and we learned on the first rescue when we were coming out with somebody that was killed in the mountains, which is terribly sad, and you just feel so bad about the loss of life and the young climbers, especially young climbers and so forth. But they would, you know, kind of begin to joke a little bit, and then we learned, Lou and I learned, that was how you could handle the tragedy of some of those things. You had to not joke about the incident, but make jokes about certain aspects of things and so forth, so that it wasn't all just a sad and terrible thing.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, good, Jim. Yeah, you bet. That was how we were taught to do it. And we remember the long-haired music they'd play on the radio going up to the mountains with them. Jim and I would be back there, and they'd be joking, talking all the way up. We were so lucky to have Wolf as a peer that would
mentor,
welcome us